Let's go on the record. It is now 1:04 p.m. on Wednesday, January 22nd, 2014. Looks like we have a quorum to do business. I'd call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. We have with us Representative Co-Chair Feinke, Vice Chair Representative Wilson, Representative Tarr, Representative Seaton, myself, Co-Chair Sadler, and a new or returning member, Representative Kawasaki. Welcome back, Representative. We have a couple members who are going to be on the way, and I see no other legislators in the audience today, but we have seats if they'd like to show up. I have killed my cell phone, so I encourage you all to do so because it makes interesting noises on the record and ghost noises on the PA. Welcome back to the second session to House Resources. Today we have the pleasure of hearing from Commissioner Larry Hartig of the Department of Environmental Conservation to give us a brief overview on some issues that have come before the committee in the past session, and about which some members had questions, and kind of bring us up to snuff as to what you've been doing this last interim, and introduce any continuing or new members of your team, Commissioner. And with that, I'll ask you to bring the microphones down a little closer, put yourself on the record, and let us know what you have for us today.
Thank you, Co-Chair Sather. Again, Larry Hartig, I'm the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, and I have a number of our senior management people with me today. Lynn Kent, who's our Deputy Commissioner, returning. I think they're all returning this year. And then we have Kristen Ryan, who's changed jobs. Larry Dietrich, our SPAR Director, Spill Prevention and Response, retired after, I think it was 37 years at DEC. We're sorry to see him go, but a well-deserved retirement. And Kristen has 10 years experience as environmental health director of that division, so she comes well seasoned and is very experienced working with the legislature, and I'm sure looking forward to work with you on any SPAR issues, including response fund, which we'll talk about in a minute. Also, we got Tom Cherian, who's our the director of the division administration. Tom's also a long-term state employee, DEC employee, moved over from the water division to become director of the DAS division. And then, you know, Michelle Bonet-Hale, she's our director of water. So that would be cruise ship, APDS, and she's been very engaged with DNR on the 404 primacy review, and that's another topic that we'll be talking about here shortly. And then Brandon Brzezinski, who may be familiar to you, he was with Representative Timmy Wilson's staff and moved over to DEC to be our legislative liaison. And he can certainly help you and your staff with any questions relating to DEC or any kind of constituent issues. So feel free to contact him at any point, too, or any of us. Did I forget anybody? I think so.
I would take this opportunity to welcome Representative Johnson to the back of the table.
Chairman, apologize for my tardiness.
That's all right.
You've all been through the whole department overview before. I think Representative Kawasaki, glad to see you back. I think he probably saw this too before, but if not, we can certainly follow up with him individually on any questions he has about the department. So at your request, what I thought I would do today is just focus on some things that are continuing from last year, particularly relating to cruise ship permitting, talk about 404 primacy, and related to that a bit about the 402 program. We'll get into that. But I thought I'd spend most of my time on response fund. And then, of course, any other issues or questions the committee members have, we'll try to field those today. And if we can't do that, we'll get back to you.
Great.
So talking about the response fund, there was language, intent language in the budget bill last year directing DEC to come back with a report to the legislature on the status of the fund, sort of the history of the spending out of that fund, and also options to try to make that fund sustainable. And so yesterday there was delivered our response to that intent language, and you have a copy with you today, and that's what I'll be referring to in my presentation here. Starting with the background on what the fund is, you're probably all somewhat familiar with it. It seems like it's a perennial topic. But the response fund was created some time ago by the legislature, and the idea behind it is that the state needs to have the resources there so that if there's a that we as we go forward with resource development in the state, whether it be oil and gas, whether it be mining, whether it be fishing, timber, whatever it is, that we're prepared for spills, because spills are likely to occur. And that we also want to have an active program in trying to prevent spills, but when they occur, we want to be ready to respond to them and respond to them as best we can. And the experience of the Exxon Valdez underscored that need to be ready, to have a plan, to have the resources available, to be trained up and ready to go at a moment's notice. And so this, how to fund this, the idea then that was to fund it out of a surcharge on crude oil production. And, of course, most of the crude oil comes from the North Slope, some from Cook Inlet. And so the crude oil that's produced that comes into the pipelines, it gets this surcharge on it. And the amount that goes into the fund here is 5 cents a barrel. And so that's been in place now since going back to the 80s. It's always been 5 cents a barrel. And so obviously the predicament is that as production goes down, you get less nickels. And so that's kind of the predicament, that leads to the predicament that we have today. But we've seen this declining production over time. You know, I mean, it hasn't come as a surprise. I've been here, I think this is my eighth legislative session now, and I've talked about this every time in the department overview, whether to resource or to finance. You know, this predicament of declining production and being able to continue to operate SPAR at its present level to meet, again, that original intent.
Mr. P, excuse me, just for the record, Representative Hawker has joined us. Representative Zito, quick question, or
yeah.
What's up?
Just a quick question. And that is, since 1980, hasn't the value of 5 cents decreased considerably as well?
Yeah, despite inflation, despite everything else, it stayed at a nickel a barrel. And so increased labor costs, increased transportation costs, all the things that have increased our cost of doing business, it's still stayed at a nickel. And at the same time, the price per barrel has climbed from $25 to $105 or whatever that change was. It's been a nickel a barrel.
Good, thank you.
Nothing's changed.
For sure.
And I'll get into some of the changes that the legislature and the administration did do to try to make the fund sustainable. But as we'll see, those were temporary measures. They weren't ultimate solutions. The 5 cents a barrel that comes in into the fund is then split. And there's a prevention account and a response account, you know, within the fund. And the prevention account is, as it says, more targeted towards prevention, but it's also used for response elements too, which I'll talk about. And that currently is 4 cents a barrel. So 4 cents of the 5 cents goes in the prevention account. The other 1 cent goes into the response account. And that 1 cent is turned on and off. The idea on the response account is you have a $50 million war chest, so to speak, so that if we have an incident where we have to get out in the field and respond quickly, there's funds there to do that immediate response. So, for example, if there was a call right now that there was a spill that we had to respond to, our SPAR division, our director, Kristen here, would send a memo to me saying that we've had this spill, we need to respond, this is our estimate of what we're going to need out of the response fund to get going on this, and then I could authorize that, and she'd have immediate access that amount out of the fund. It's already there, it doesn't need to go, and then later what would happen, we'd come back and report to the legislature, and it'd get appropriated and everything gets squared up. But there's that $50 million fund that's available there for immediate response. That fund, though, then gets the money gets used to bring it back up to $50 million. It can be done. It's done several ways. One is we do cost recovery against the responsible party, recover back from them, and then that comes back. The legislature appropriates that recovery back into the prevention account or response account, excuse me, and brings it back up. Or if it's a situation where we can't get total cost recovery, then that 1 cent a barrel surcharge turns back on and it stays on until it gets back up to $50 million. So the idea is that war chest will always be there. On the prevention account side, the 4 cents a barrel, that goes gets appropriated over to be used for the operating expenses for our spill prevention and response division. You know, that's the main source of funding. If you looked at our funding sources, for DEC and specifically to our SPAR division, you would see a big chunk of that is going to be a response fund. That's what it is today. And so the funding on SPAR, and that's why I stopped there. I've got one of the handouts we have here is this bar chart here. And this gives you the numbers. I'm not going to try to walk through all these numbers unless you want me to. I'll do that with finance. But at the bottom of the page, what you get here, it just by color shows you the change here in fund sources. The kind of pinkish line across the top, that's SPAR's operating budget. And it shows it going down a bit, and then it shows it flat, you know, going off into the future, fiscal year 15 forward. So you assume flat funding for SPAR at a little bit above $15 million annually. And then you look at the funding sources. The green bars, that's what was being paid for out of the prevention account historically. The purple bars are that's cost recovery, where that gets appropriated by the legislature back in the prevention account. You can see it took a big bump in fiscal year 14, gave us some relief. That's the arbitration award that we got in the BP corrosion case, the 2006. There was two corrosion incidents, and then the state pursued claims against BP, wanted an arbitration, and about $10 million of the recovery went to DEC for to go back for cost recovery, and the rest went into the Constitutional Budget Reserve, I believe. The lighter color there at the bottom is the general fund. Or excuse me, the blue line would be the general fund. And so that if you look at going into the future, that blue line at the top replaces the green. That's because the prevention account with is basically there's not enough production to keep SPAR going, so you have to replace the green with the blue, which is would be general fund increments. And you can see that's a fairly large amount. You know, it's more like $6 million or so annually. So that's what declining oil production is doing to the prevention account. Going back to the page on response to intent, I'd like to summarize some of the things that have been done both by the department and with the help of the legislature and the governor's office to try to make the account sustainable. This isn't a complete list, but this is most of the larger items. The largest change that was made was about 4 years or more ago, and that was where the formula was changed from, it used to be 3 cents would go into the prevention account and 2 cents into the response account, and that was changed to 4 cents and 1 cent. And so that really helped. Some of the other things that have happened over time is there's things that used to be paid for out of the prevention account that were wholly legal, certainly within the statutory authority and past any audits. But those things, because they were drawing down the fund and they didn't seem to be as tied to the core mission of the fund, you know, as set by the original intent that I described in the statutes, we backed off using that. For instance, state-owned or state-managed contaminated sites. We stopped paying for those, you know, out of the response fund some time ago, and the legislature started seeing not annual but almost annual capital requests, usually around $3 million from the department, and then those were that's what funded contaminated sites rather than response fund. There were some of the other agencies like DOT and Department of Military and Veterans Affairs for spill response-related activities that were being funded out of the fund. That stopped some of these like 5-8 years ago. In conversation with legislators, some of them have been around a while, they say, well, why are you still using the fund to pay for this? Well, we haven't been for 8 years, you know. And just reminded that there's a lot of this we've gone through to try to pare back, and so it's just kind of down to the bare bones of operating expenses for SPAR. But even with all that paring back and the switch from the 3-2 to the 4-1 split, it's just reached a point where the production's down such that there's just really not other options like that to extend it. And some of the other things that were looked at, including, I know, by this committee last year with Representative Seaton, is you could increase the surcharge itself. Then the question, and this becomes way outside of DEC's purview, one, whether philosophically, you know, this is a new tax and how you would view that, and how the public would view it, whether that would have any in any way discourage production or new fields, whether that is appropriate given that SPAR's activities cover a lot more than crude oil. In fact, if you look at the number of spills we have in the state and the amount of the types of things that are spilled, crude oil doesn't even make the top five in terms of things that are spilled. Diesel fuel's by far the top, and they're just individual spills here and there. If you look at it by industry sector, oil and gas is not near the top. I mean, it's others. And yet, that's where the surcharge goes. It's on crude oil, and that's what pays for SPAR. And so that's kind of a more of a policy decision, too. But if you're looking at putting more of a burden on the oil and gas industry, you'd have to, I think, get into those kind of policy questions.
Commissioner, Co-Chair, if I has a question on this topic.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, does your department have a breakdown of, I know where the revenue to the fund comes from, mm-hmm. but do you have a little more of a detailed breakdown on where the expenses go out in terms of, basically, I guess, what I'm thinking of is by industry sector. You mentioned that oil and gas really doesn't contribute to any draws, right. any significant draws on the fund compared to, you know, things like trucks rolling over or ships hitting a rock or something like that. Where are the and what industries are those expenses occurring in that are helping to deplete the fund?
Right. Co-Chair, right through the chair, that's a very good question. Because what I said was is that if you look at the volumes that are spilled and the industry sectors responsible for the sales spills, you don't see crude oil near the top. That doesn't necessarily mean that in terms of agency attention that they're not near the top, mm-hmm. because it is true that we have oil spill contingency plans, that there's a lot of those for the oil and gas industry, for the tanks, the pipelines, and those are periodically updated. There's a lot of new technology that needs to be reviewed as part of updating those plans. There's a lot of work that's being done to get to your question, though. Could we provide a breakdown? I think we could provide some estimates, but there'd have to be some judgment into how that's allocated, among them. But I would say that I wouldn't say that the number of spills and the volume of spills is an indication of time the agency spends on a particular sector.
If you can get us whatever information on the chair with the chair, we can divvy it around to the committee members. That'd be nice. Yeah. Nice to know. On this topic, the director. Okay, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Same topic, and I guess specific questions. Several years ago, we had a boat run aground out in the Aleutians. It was full of grain. Mm-hmm. Was our response funded out of this fund?
Representative Johnson, to the chair. I think what you're probably referring to is the Salandang year of soybeans.
Right.
It also had, this was before my time, so I'm kind of going by what I've learned. And but it also had fuel oil on board, its own, and that's what you see with these large ocean-going ships. They can have a million gallons of fuel on board plus whatever lubricants, et cetera. So there could be a big spill despite their cargo, and that was kind of the situation there. But the short answer is yes, that was the response fund was available. And then there was a criminal action, I believe, that was brought with them that was a joint federal-state effort. And as a result of that, there was a settlement, I believe, and then there was funds that came to the state as part of that. And in fact, it's still money that we're using today in terms of the Aleutian Island risk assessment that's being paid for, by part of that settlement.
Follow up. And my understanding is the settlement money goes into prevention.
Well, what you get
settlements and lawsuits, if I read the chart right, provided.
Yes, through the chair, what we have was one of the handouts here is this graphic that I'm holding up, and it shows the response fund on one side and the prevention on the other, all within the response fund. And so on the cost recovery, you can see there's some holding accounts there. There's the surcharge account, and there's the response mitigation account. And so if we do cost recovery, it's the blue balloon kind of on the left side there, down below the 1 cent. And you see that we do cost recovery, what would happen is it would be deposited in this response mitigation account. then there would be a legislative appropriation back into the response account.
And for the record, this is a document entitled Oil and Hazardous Substance Release Prevention and Response Fund, revised 11-1-2010, just for the record. So, President Johnson, follow-up.
So, and if I could, on that, before I ask my next question, so the fines go into the prevention, and are they available for response, or would it be appropriate for us to put all those fines into the prevention and remove the cap? I mean, I'm just wondering how best, you know, if we get that money and it's in some place we can't really use for response, or maybe it can be. I'm just looking at some solutions from the on the response side.
Again, through the chair, I think some of the things that you would want to look at, and considering that, if you go back to the earlier chart that I looked at, or it's the Department of Environmental Conservation Prevention account, revenues, expenditures, and balance projections. And at the bottom, looking at those bar charts there, you can see the cost recovery is that dark purple line. And so that kind of gives you the amount that you would be talking about, that if you took that and you appropriated that into the prevention side rather than the response account, you know, on average, that's about what you would see year to year. And you can see what we've projected into the future years is kind of an average, running average. And you can compare that to the lighter royal blue line above, and you can see it's not near as big. So the short answer is it wouldn't be enough unless we start having a lot more spills and we're trying to go the opposite direction. And it's kind of self-defeating, too, because it's money in, it's money out.
Right.
I mean, it's not...
I mean, once again, just kind of looking...
Yeah, it's not replacing just kind of declining production. It's just...
One more question.
Last one, though. Okay.
The fishing vessel that overturned in the... Was, I don't think it was the Naknak, but one of the rivers out in western Alaska. Mm-hmm. Was that paid for, the prevention or the response paid for out of this account?
Through the chair, I try to remember if the initial response, we might have drawn on the response fund, but what often happens, and I'm not sure I could find out, get report back on that particular one, but what often happens is if we have an immediate response we need to do, we'll tap the response fund, and then we will negotiate with the responsible party so that they'll just start paying our bills. And so we don't have to run it through, and then we'll do, you know, it'll avoid a cost recovery. We'll just agree that they'll get a bill monthly. We'll go over it with them. They'll pay it. And so it's not having to be drawn out of the response fund. And then what would happen is at some point, too, we would go back and say, this is what we've drawn out of the response fund. We need to recover that. Usually it's voluntary. It's usually worked out.
Thank you.
So it's a temporary, sometimes it's just a temporary account that we use, and then we go directly to the responsible party.
Questions from Co-Chair Feige, then Seaton, but I want to let you get back on track. There might be some of the questions that we're elucidating now that we'll get to. So having recognized them, with your indulgence, those two questions, Feige, then Seaton, and then back to the Commissioner's report.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your Representative Johnson mentioned the $50 million that's currently capped in the response account. You know, given that if there is an incident of some kind, money has to get spent initially to make the response, and then there is cost recovery to replenish the fund and go after who is responsible and try to collect. But that takes time. What kind of exposure do we have in terms of the $50 million? My basic question is that enough given the cost of responding to something, say, in a very remote part of Alaska? Is $50 million sufficient to mount an adequate response? And is it enough to satisfy sort of the cash flow need before cost recovery can return funds to the response account?
Yeah, of course, if I get through the chair, we've looked at that question. Again, it's sort of predicting the future, but if we look at what we think are the big risks out there that could result in a response that would go over $50 million, there's a couple of factors that one considers. One is that under both federal and state law, the person that owns or operates the facility from which the spill occurs They're the ones that are primarily responsible, ultimately, but also for the response itself. So, if, like, for instance, the Deepwater Horizon incident down there in the Gulf, BP was the responsible party. It was their response. You didn't see the Coast Guard out there setting the boom and igniting the crude on the water and trying to do the well kill and all those things. That was BP doing it. The Coast Guard's role, EPA's role, the state's role down there was the oversight to make that sure that's done. So it wasn't money that's being spent on the response itself, you know, by the government entities. And that's the same thing here in Alaska. So if we had a big event, chances are it would be a big player, and chances are they would have the resources to do it, or they would have a contingency plan with DEC already that would talk about how they respond, and they'd have financial assurances that would have to be in place under state law to back that plan up. They'd have contracts with oil spill response organizations that would be ready to go, and those would be tied in with national response assets. On the federal side, too, there's an oil spill trust liability fund, which Congress raised after the Deepwater Horizon. So that's out there, too. So you have these different layers. It's not like we just have the $50 million and that's it. And so when I put all that together, I still feel comfortable with the $50 million, but I think it's worth asking that question as we go forward. And we may be back at some point, but not at this time, with some recommendations.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay. Over to Seaton, and then Commissioner Hardick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for clarification on fines and lawsuits and settlements, is it statutorily required that that money goes in here, or is that a legislative designation? I know we talked somewhat about some of the money from large settlement went into the CBR. So is this... I guess my concern is if we are in deficit spending and looking forward into financial problems, if that's voluntarily designated by the legislature, it may not be a real secure source of funding. Is that the case, or is it statutorily designated that those come back to the fund?
The short answer is the legislature always has the power of appropriation, and so it, in as the one graphic, the Oil and Hazardous Substance Prevention Fund one pager, that's what it shows, is that any money that we spend has to be appropriated by the legislature ultimately. What happened on the BP arbitration case is that there's a constitutional provision relating to the constitutional budget reserve, and so that trumped everything, you know, because it's constitutional provision, is my understanding. And so even though we had statutes that we may have been able to interpret to say more of that arbitration award could have gone into the response fund in light of the constitutional directive that said it's, if it's recovery of royalties and lease payments and that sort of thing has to go in constitutional budget reserve. The call with the administration was, we're not going to tinker with the Constitution, it's going to go there. And so that's in the $10 million, that was just strictly cost recovery. That's money that had been advanced out of the response fund to the Department of Law as part of the investigation. We were just getting back what we spent. The safety in the response fund, if you want to call it that, against changes year to year on budget pressure, so you always know you have that capability there where we started with, you know, the intent here has been that you had a reserve, you know, that you had a surplus in that account that you could work off of, and so it was always there. And so unless the legislature went in and reappropriated what was already in the fund, it was pretty secure. Now that fund's going to be zero, so it's going to be, you know, starting perhaps as early as at the end of fiscal 2015, it may stretch out depending on cost recoveries and other variables, but at that point it's going to be zero, and so it'll be nothing but appropriation plus any surcharge on new production.
You know, Commissioner, I'm going to ask you to clarify that your question was, are the fines to the response fund in statute? The answer was no, it's not, but just clarify that for the record, please.
It's in statute.
It is in statute.
It's in statute. But there's no dedicated fund. I mean, there's nothing that binds the legislature year once binds future legislatures to make certain appropriations, you know, by statute. And so it's not in the Constitution. It's, you know, so it's subject to whatever the legislature wants to do year to year, is my understanding.
Yeah, okay, great. With I want to make sure I give that, I think you might answer some questions. So please continue with your presentation on the Oldsmobile Response and Restoration Fund.
I was just talking about some of the steps that the division took, the administration took with the legislature's help to try to sustain the fund. One, just to kind of dispel the notion that we've just been sitting here for 8-10 years and nothing's been done is to try to sustain the fund. A lot's happened, and they say the biggest one was that percentage switch, the 3-2 to the 4-1. But, you know, not paying for certain things out of the fund. But the other thing we've been doing is we've really been holding the department at a flat level for some time. I think it's been, what, almost 10 years and with two PCNs added. And it's been, I mean, it's been a really, despite OCS coming on and all the other things that are new and the corrosion issues and the cases, and we have upped our regulation of flow lines, which are the lines that were the main culprit in corrosion that go from the wellhead to the gathering centers where the water and the sediments are taken out before it goes to, down to the transmission lines. I mean, we've added a lot of duties to the division, but kept it pretty stable in terms of its size and cost. And there's been efficiencies that we've been instituting, including efficiencies just this year in how we track and collect on cost recovery. So there's, but these things just can't overcome the fact of declining production. You know, it's just too significant. And so that kind of leads us where it is, and the picture is that, again, that towards the end of fiscal year 2015, thereabouts, absent some other input into the fund that might extend it for a little bit, like cost recovery, the, you know, the writing's on the wall. Within the next 2 years, certainly it's going to be down to zero, and it'll stay there until there's quite a bit more production. And so that's my prepared remarks on the response fund.
Thank you. On that subject, we'll take some questions now. So we have Representative Kawasaki, then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the spreadsheets that we got this year. We got similar spreadsheets a year before that showed that it might be stretched out until FY16, and now we're looking at it today again, having the same conversations over and over. In your discussion, though, you mentioned increasing the per barrel surcharge. Is that something the administration has looked at, or is it just one of those general suggestions?
No, that's just something that came up last year in this committee. That's why I touched on that. The administration last year, there was also intent language that requested OMB respond to basically the same questions, and OMB came back and is quoted in this year's intent language towards the beginning section. And what the administration has proposed that is continuing to propose is just pay as you go. You know, that gap year to year would be filled with appropriations from the general fund. And again, if you wanted to get into questions like that, I just pointed out some of the policy questions you'd run into. And there's other things that people have looked at. They looked at spreading the surcharge to refined products, but then you get into, well, how far down the chain do you go, and how much money do you spend on instituting a program, and how painful is that for the consumer for what you get? And so it gets into a lot of policy questions where the system we've had after this production issue has been pretty straightforward. Maybe not some people's mind fair to the oil and gas industry since it pays for everything, but straightforward.
Yeah.
Second. Just
go follow up to that, Representative Kawasaki.
Actually, it was just a separate question. It was just on, it had to do with the cost recovery and the ability of the department to recover those costs and how frequently. And I know it mentions in your statement that there's a new system that you've been trying out. Can you just tell me the successes of those changes?
Yes, through the chair, it's pretty successful. I can get you the actual percentages because that's something that we report on. I didn't bring it today, but we do report on that annually, and so we can just provide that again. That's not a problem. But it's in the high 90s, if I remember right. I don't know. I will get it for you, but I described by memory from last time I looked at it a year ago or so. But but there's some practicalities around it, too, and I'll just mention those. One is that do go bankrupt. Some spills outstrip their ability to pay, you know, regardless of whether they would want to pay. The other thing that you run into, and I'm very sympathetic to this from my prior experience as an attorney in private practice, is you have the mom-and-pop situation with the home heating fuel tank that they didn't know that corroded, and they find out years later, and you know, it's a $100,000 mess. And so it's, you know, we don't, the language that we have in the statute says the commissioner shall recover. But the way we've interpreted that is that we can work with the Department of Law, which always has the authority to look at the particular circumstances of the state's claim and adjust that. And so we work with them closely on that. And if it looks like that we're just chasing somebody that's bankrupt or somebody that can't pay or that the cost of recovery is not worth it or whatever, then there's some adjustment. But that's the odd case.
So just to clarify, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
On the, so when you say 90% or upper 90%, are you talking about the total dollar amounts that are expended versus
I believe that's back? Correct. Yes, I believe that's correct. But we'll get to the right figures. I'm just saying it's not an opportunity to get the fund back up to being a sustainable level.
Good deal. Representative Wilson, question? Yeah. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just so that I have this in my head correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, because it's not a dedicated fund, it doesn't automatically go back into the fund. And so then it's up to the legislature to put it back through appropriation, and that just doesn't always happen.
Through the chair, from my knowledge, it's always happened. The legislature has always done that appropriation, and in fact, some years, and it's in the response to the intent language, the legislature has even done capital infusions to try to bring the fund back up. I mean, the legislature supported the fund all along. I can't think of any instance where they took funds out or didn't direct funds back in that were intended to go back in there by statute.
Okay, good. Thank you, because that I was confused on that point. Okay.
Just mm-hmm. Question, you see just from your chart there's about a 6.6 slight escalation shortcoming. Is that GF money as a placeholder in the governor's budget request for FY15?
That's good, I didn't follow you.
I'm sorry, 16, go ahead.
So I'm looking at fiscal year 16 on the chart?
Yeah, on the one, the bar charts.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just historical, that's a placeholder based on the historical?
Yeah, these are estimates going forward. Yeah, and so that in fiscal year 15, you don't see in the governor's budget a general fund increment.
Right.
And the reason is that there's still a balance, and it's mainly historical, that when there were some adjustments made about, well, it's over 10 years ago, it was before my time, it resulted in a surplus in the response fund. And so when the production wasn't able to, and the surcharge wasn't able to keep up with ongoing SPAR expenses, we started going into that reserve, and the reserve then is depleted, as you see with this kind of light brown, that when it hits the bottom there, it would have hit bottom, but then we had the BP arbitration award, that bumped it back up, that $10 million, gave it a little bit of life, and then it fell back down. So in fiscal year 16, it's gone to zero. The balance, so you see in fiscal year 16, if you look at the top of the page, there would be no money being transferred over into fiscal year 16 from the response fund. It'd be zero, and so it'd have to be, you know, what was collected that year out on the declining production and backfilled with appropriation.
Okay, good. Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question, while we're looking at that chart, I see the projection is flat or possibly slightly down in all these future years, so there's no calculation for inflation of costs over time. Is that, am I interpreting that correctly, that you're looking at costing the same 10 years from now as it costs now to do this job?
Well, to the chair, this is illustrative. I mean, it depends on what level of service that we're going to be providing, and with inflation and labor costs, it wouldn't be the same level of service. This is just to show that even if you assume level pretty flat funding, which we've been trying trying to achieve, you know, trying to sustain our drawing of, trying to sustain the fund by limiting our draw on the fund, that even in that case, you're still going to have a significant general fund increment that would need to be added.
Right, and the purpose of that, Mr. Chairman, was just to say that, you know, we're not looking at real lines, we're looking at assumption projections that discount at inflation. I mean, we have to say inflation for that expense line is zero for the next 10 years. And so our situation is probably worse if we're going to maintain the same services that we're maintaining currently. And that was what that question, you know, was trying to get to. But the other portion was that I wanted to ask about smaller operators. There's been concerns in Cook Inlet and other places of smaller operators and the potential for bankruptcies, which could be in larger spill, you know, not the mom and pop thing, but the larger spill. So what is the bond requirements, and have we done anything like the federal government did in increasing the bonding requirements so that we don't have to worry as much about that being the case of somebody not being able to meet those response costs or going bankrupt?
Just to clarify, what are bond requirements for whom exactly?
For operators, oil and gas operators in the state of Alaska.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, if I recall, we have maybe a dozen seed plans in place in Cook Inlet now, and a number of those would be for the new operators that are in there doing exploration, gas and crude, and they're all required to have financial assurances to support those, but I don't know of anything we've done new in terms of upping those requirements. I was looking over at our division directors. Nothing recently, but we haven't lowered the bar. I mean, the expectation that is, if somebody comes in new to the state, that they're going to be able to perform right up with the level that people have been here 40 years, and that they're going to be backed up with financial assurances. The bonding requirements that you referred to, those might be a bit different. Those were imposed by land managers, I think, federal land managers, where we're the environmental response organization. We're just looking at response plans and the financial ability to perform that plan versus, say, like DNR or somebody else that might be looking at damage to resources and other things in terms of their bonding. So that might be a question for them, too.
And Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, maybe we could get a paper or email or something to the committee so that we understand what that is, because it's been expressed by a number of people about new entrants, new smaller players, and I'm not sure what that financial liability, financial security is. If it's just people with a small balance sheet saying, yes, I'm going to be financially capable of doing it, or whether the state requires something and what that level is. So if you could provide that to the committee, we'd appreciate that.
Are you asking about land-based resource damage bonding requirements, or more specifically on spill response?
On spill response, oil and gas development and spill response.
Okay.
Yes, Julia, we can certainly provide that. Also, just to add to that, though, we have been looking at our C plan requirements in terms of the new players coming in, the types of activities that they're engaged in, what we learned from the golf experience. And so you were asking about financial assurances, but there's other aspects to C plans that we look at. And you raise a good question, and it's a challenge for us, is when you bring in new players, new companies that are unfamiliar to Alaska, and we don't know them, they don't know us, they don't initially know the working environment up here. Cook Inlet is pretty unique. I mean, it's second highest tides in North America. It has ice, it has volcanoes, it has a lot of seismic activity, it has derricks out there, it has shipping traffic coming in and out of Anchorage, it has a world-class fishery in the Kenai River, and those are the ones that come to mind right away. And so I think of Cook Inlet, I think, yeah, that's a challenging area for a new operator, and so we're very aware of that. We look look at that in terms of our sea plans, and we do have the same concerns, share the concerns that you raise.
Commissioner, I got a question for you. Last year, we heard from you that about half of the contaminated sites in Alaska are on federal land. In your opinion, how good a job are the federal agencies doing on cleaning up those contaminated sites on their area of jurisdiction?
It continues to be a challenge, Chairman Zadler. That's correct. You remember correctly. We have about 2,000 reported sites, new reported spills each year. I say reported because I assume that some don't get reported that happen. And of those, I would guess that maybe a couple of dozen would really rise to the top, you know, where we'd be thinking response fund, we'd be thinking agency response, we'd be talking about the system. A lot of them would be things that get reported, and then we talk about what they need to do, they do it, and it's wrapped up. You know, it's not like there's a big agency response. But then if you look at it historically, not just new spills, but historically, then you see historically there's a lot of spills left over from the federal government having even a bigger role in Alaska. And so that's where you get the 2,000. A lot of them are historical sites. So it's getting the federal government to appropriate the money to go back and deal with those sites. And we see it like on the North Slope with the legacy well sites. There's about 138 of those, I think, somewhere in that range. There's been progress made on that over the last year, but it's a struggle. And then we saw it with some of the military sites, old landfills. We see it, the UNIMAC sites, a big contaminated site left over from NPRA. There's lots of sites that need attention, federal sites. And you run into questions about federal primacy, or you know, whether we can sovereign immunity, whether we can force the federal agency to do something, whether they have to follow our rules, whether they can get their own appropriation out of Washington, D.C., whether they're higher national priorities. So we just don't have the same handle on them as we do the private party. So it's a bit of a struggle, but I'd say over the last year there's been more progress. In fact, if you look at our budget for this year, there's actually an increment in there for federal receipts for SPAR, anticipating, I think it's about 900,000, somewhere in that range, 900,000 increase in federal funds in the next year or so for contaminated sites. So it's gone the right direction here recently.
And if it's an increase of 900,000 more, raising it to what total number? Go to your lifeline.
I'm looking to our admin services director if he has it off the top of his head.
And if you're going to give, you got to come up on record. And
yeah, it's Tom Cherry, and he's our director of administrative services.
If you have. Please put yourself on the record on the mic, sweet.
For the record, my name is Tom Cherry, administrative services for the Division of Admin Services. To understand the question, your question is what is the increment request for FY15 from the federal funds?
The question is if there is a $900,000 increase, what's the total amount increased to?
I do not have the number right now. Yeah.
But we'll get it. It's federal receipt authority that will be used by SPAR for federal contaminated sites.
Okay. Thanks, Jim. Yeah. And Representative Tarr and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just want to look at the projection side of this chart here just a little bit. And so the pink bars represent the surcharge value that will be assessed, you know, in all these years going forward. And I'm just wondering why we don't see any increases, why that's on a complete downward slope there. Just thinking of some of the projects that are underway and are going to be bringing some new oil online in the very near future, this year, next year. And then, you know, and I'm not surprised by seeing a dip then for the few following years, but have you looked, or at what point would you be predicting an increase in the amount being received on the per barrel surcharge related to new oil development? Mm-hmm. And have you figured out, I guess, in thousands of barrels or something, you know, what that would mean to turn the curve?
Yeah, Representative Tarr, through the chair, the projections that we rely on are Department of Revenue projections. We don't mm-hmm. do our own. And we would certainly like to see, and that's the governor's plan and the legislature's plan, I believe, is to see an upward swing on that. But we don't know as a department exactly when that'll be, and so that's why we're showing it this way. But that, the other aspect of it is that there are current exploration activities, like on the OCS, but that's on federal waters, and so, you know, targeting our surcharge out there. If we can do that, we would. But so the production we're looking at here would have to be new production on state lands or state waters, and we just don't see the assurance there that that's within 10 years.
And forgive me, Commissioner, I think I read someplace that 1.01 million barrels a year would generate enough revenue for
it. Yeah, and that's in the response to intent language, that number.
All right, good deal. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned earlier that the oil industry was a small portion of your total response. Are other industries required to post the same kind of bonds? And pardon me, Representative Seaman, I'm going to pick on the fishing industry a little bit. Do fishing vessels have to post the same kind of bonds that, say, an oil company does, or a trucking company that does that? Is that a requirement?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, some types of operations facilities have to have contingency plans. And then if they have a contingency plan, then they have to also have financial assurances. On the mining side, they may also have to have reclamation requirements, both with DNR and with us, that may like get into long-term water quality treatment. And so I'd have to kind of know the operation. But the short answer is there's no surcharge, you know, ongoing surcharge on what's produced, you know, from the other industry sectors. There may be financial assurance requirements for sea plan performance. There might be restoration requirements, reclamation requirements that have associated bonding with them, but there's no surcharge.
I think we can talk about this later.
I anticipate we will.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Other questions for the Commissioner on the topic of oil spill response and restoration funding?
Since we're on the topic of sea plans are public documents. I think we've had some of the discussion before. You know, they're large documents. Is DEC getting those electronically submitted? And since they're public documents, will DEC post those so that people don't have to go to Anchorage and sit down with a hard copy book and can actually review public documents in the usual public way that we now have of being able to research those online?
I'll have to get our SPAR director up here. Yes, the latest and greatest answer on that, if that's okay.
And Commissioner, if you could lay out what's the current situation, what the public access availability is there now, and then what Representative Seaton.
Right. I realize there's an ongoing request from Representative Seaton, so I want to give him the latest information. And if I may, this is Kristen Ryan.
And please give us your title.
For the record, my name is Kristen Ryan. I'm the Director for the Division of Spill Prevention and Response for the Department of Environmental Conservation. And I just missed the first part of your question, Representative Seaton. Was it the contingency plans you wanted to have public access to?
Well, yes, I believe they're public documents, and people have public access to them. But in the past, you've had to go to your office during working hours and try to review them there when, obviously, things are submitted electronically or can be submitted electronically. They're all created electronically by companies, and posting those public documents online would allow the public to review those in a much more way that they can help the state of Alaska make sure that there aren't holes in those documents as well from a public aspect.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the one problem we have with posting those items online is the confidentiality information, and most companies claim large portions of their contingency plan is confidential, and so it's sort of an ongoing debate we have with the operators to even have coffees ourselves. Often they make us go to their location as well to review the information that they don't want to have, because they know if they give it to us, it becomes public. So we don't even actually have hard copies of all the information in the contingency plan. We review it and we make sure it's there, but it's not necessarily in our hands. Now, the information they do give us, yes, we make that public and available, and I'll look into our process for putting it online. I know we're updating our database that stores that information for one of the very purpose, not only to make it easier for our staff to work on it, but also make it more readily available to the public. But there will always be portions that are restricted currently.
Yeah, if I may add to that response is, it's not necessarily confidential business information, it's Homeland Security type information, because you know, if you look at the Trans-Alaska pipeline and you look at fuel storage around the state, and so there's a heightened concern around that, and so it's still kind of a work in progress of where you draw that line. And we have a strong interest, as I know you do, in full public access. But at the other hand, where the companies are, and to us, are a certain extent constrained by security issues, including with the federal government. And in terms of getting things posted, I can say as a department that's the direction we want to go. And it's just more of a question of resources and the size of some of these plans, because they could be multiple volumes. And these are, particularly if you're looking at the oil company plans like in Prince William Sound and Cook Inlet, they can be very large files.
I will observe that the technology makes many things possible which aren't always practicable. But Representative Seaton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. But, you know, the reason why there are requirements for public disclosure is because people in the various industries are probably more in tune to making sure that the C plans will be fulfilled. I mean, when we're talking about the Pilots Association and, you know, the people in your department are good, but they don't have the expertise that the Marine pilots do. And so when there's something in a C plan that makes no sense, you don't know that it doesn't make any sense. So unless the Marine pilots have access to that to say, wait a minute, this may be a contingency plan, but it isn't going to work. And so I'm, again, wanting to make sure that we get the best contingency plans that are actually going to work in the areas of the state. And if there are those things that have to be confidential for some reason, then hopefully there can be required to put those in blocks and label those as exactly why they need to be confidential, so that they're not reviewable. But the actual funding or functioning of a contingency plan needs to be reviewed to make sure that it's a workable document. So I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for letting me explain why I want to get this information, because we're protected by these plans, but we're only protected by the plans if they're functional plans. So,
Mr. Chairman, may I add something?
Director Ryan.
Thank you. Representative Seaton, through the chair, one thing, we are proposing some regulation changes in the next couple of weeks, hopefully, assuming the commissioner agrees, to allow electronic submittals of information for C-plans, which we currently don't have. So it would, if they provide it to us electronically, it'll be easier for us to provide it to the public electronically. So assuming that all works out through the process, we should put those out for comment in the next 2 months or so.
I really appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions on this topic for either the commissioner or director? Representative Johnson.
And maybe it's a question for you, Mr. Chairman. I heard us talk about the industries and what proportion of the response was by industry. Have we requested that breakdown? And if not, could we get that as to where that response goes, whether it's trucking or agriculture or oil and gas, or just if I could get a breakdown through the committee of where that money and where those responses go, and you know, quite frankly, if the oil industry is paying 100%, and they're not 100% of the problem, there needs to be some cost sharing, in my opinion. So I'd just like to kind of see the breakdown if it's available.
Yeah. I understand that was the request. I hope you can accommodate that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we have that. In fact, right after I'm done here, I go over to Senate Resources and give an overview, and that's part of that presentation. So I'll make sure you get that part of the presentation.
Follow-up?
Well, I was just wondering, since, you know, we are separate bodies, you have the information now.
I can get it to you right now.
You know, it's anything to save the commissioner some time.
Oh, I can hear it. You're well.
Mr. Chairman, while he's pulling that up, if I could, I didn't mean to not give you the answer, Representative Kawasaki, about the percentage of cost recovery, but we're really revamping our cost recovery system right now, and it's hard for me to have a clear idea about how much we actually are recovering, but I hope to have that answer soon.
Thank you. And I think we got staff to make a copy of that or make it available to us before we leave here, if you got it in your pocket there. And then we do have two other topics to address with the commissioner's presence, so we'll make this one of the last questions.
I was just curious as to whether we're talking about cost sharing of other industries, or the state anyway, the citizens of the state. And so if the amount is of cost to the spill prevention response, the nickel, reduces costs, and now we've changed so we're taxing oil on profit, does that nickel come off as an expense of the participants so that we're actually paying the people of the state paying 35% generally? So on that.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I don't know the answer to that. I believe that the response, the surcharge, is in that same area of the statutes, and so there's some relationship there. And I know in the past, like for, I mean, going clear back to the ACES discussion, I was up here talking about what sometimes called the 470 fund, because that's the bill that was originally created this, and the response fund, it's also called. And at the time, I remember there was a general reluctance to deal with this because it was part of the same package and would confuse things. I remember that discussion with several legislators that were deciding whether they would take it on or not. So I know that they're related, but how they're related, I don't know. We'd have to get Department of Revenue up here to answer that one. But I can quickly give you those numbers if you just want the numbers for spills.
Was the committee able to get copies of that for people in the hard copy version?
Are they making them now?
You know, if you want to put the record now, Commissioner, just to...
Oh, yeah, I can just do it real quickly. Just okay. In 2013, and this is not that much different than just the last few years, we had 344 spills to water that were reported. We had 1,430 that were reported to land. In terms of volume, 69% of the spills were diesel fuel, 13% aviation fuel, 7% hydraulic oil, 3% engine lube oil, 3% gasoline, and 6% other.
I'm sorry, 3% engine lube. Say again the rest.
2% gasoline, and we'll get you copies of this.
Good.
But
okay.
And then 6% of the volume was other. And my guess is, and we could dig into this deeper, but that would be produced water. It would be associated with whether it's mining or whatever operation, just part of the operation, and that would also include crude. So, I mean, it's less than 6%. It would be some fraction of 6%.
And do you have those broken up by industry sector?
Not in the packet that I got. We have it.
Mr. Chairman, that is what I would be interested
right,
in,
Commissioner
more
Johnson,
than the
Johnson.
Percentage of diesel versus
right.
Where it came from more than what it was.
Right.
But the way, those are all refined products other than the other, which is more than crude oil, and that's 6%. So right there you can see it's for the crude oil production, it's not the big player in terms of at least recent spills. But that doesn't mean it can't at some point be the real big spill of the year.
True. but you can get us by industry?
Yeah, we can get that to you, too.
Okay, being 10 after 2, we got 45 minutes or so for the remaining two items, so if you'll continue with your presentation on the other two topics,
Sure, and these are much shorter, I think, but these are all good questions. I don't want to cut off any good questions.
But no, that's fascinating.
I don't want to assume anything. But these are status reports, these two now, strictly status reports. The first is on 404 wetlands primacy.
I just remind everybody, 404 is for?
Yep, Section 404 of the Clean Water Act. That's the section that provides that people that want to place fill material into waters of the United States have to get a permit. And right now they would have to go to the Corps of Engineers to get the permit. And in preparing the permit, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers would be looking at federal statutes, including regulations that EPA approves. And so EPA is a big hand in 404 permits, too. But there is the ability under the Clean Water Act for the state to take what's called primacy of 404 permitting. That's where, rather than the Corps of Engineers issuing the permit, a state would issue the permit, or agency within the state would issue the permit. And that's what we did under the 402 program, which is the wastewater discharge permitting program. That's discharge of pollutants in the water of the United States as opposed to discharge of fill material in the waters of the United States. And we got primacy of that program in status from EPA over the last 6 years or so. And now we have full primacy of that. So the idea on the 404 program is to look at it. That was what the legislature authorized, was for DNR and DEC to work together to evaluate the pros and cons of the state taking primacy of the 404 program. It made sense to look at it because the majority of the wetlands in the United States are in Alaska. Most large projects involve wetlands, a lot of community projects, whether it's schools, libraries, et cetera, involve wetlands. So it just makes sense that the state should be looking at 404. And it also made sense to our department because we already have groundwater quality, DNR has water quantity, we have surface water with the NPDES program. If we had the 404 program, then that means we could have a more integrated approach to water management and permitting in the state, and that would have some efficiencies and to it in itself. So where we're at, again, is to look at whether the state should take primacy. That's the issue that we need to report to the legislature on. DEC and DNR have formed up a team of people that are working on this from each agency. That's their task. We've been working closely with the two other states that already have primacy of the 404 program, and those are New Jersey and Michigan. We've also had a lot of discussion with Oregon. They're also pursuing 404 right now. They're much further down the path than we are, and they are within Region 10 of EPA. And again, it's EPA that has to approve an application for primacy. And so we're very engaged with EPA Region 10 and along with Oregon on what the rules are in Region 10 to get primacy, what the expectation, what we would get, what it would look like, that sort of thing, what the costs are, what kind of staff would it take. So there's a lot of good information that we're getting from the other states. We're also getting a lot of good cooperation from the Corps of Engineers and EPA. We've entered into a memorandum of understanding with them that talks about how we're going to collaborate in investigating the pros and cons of this, how they're going to share information with us and help us evaluate this. They see the utility in the state taking primacy. They think that, so I think they're fully behind us evaluating this. We've been back to EPA and headquarters and also talking with the people at the Corps back in D.C. About the requirements at a federal level. We've also, through the Department of Law, have put together a kind of a working draft of the regulations, because if we were going to do an application, it has to be the whole thing. They have to see your regulations, they have to see your statutes, they have to see, you know, who, what kind of your staff organization, they have to see your budget. You have to be ready to go before they even consider your application. And by developing the regulations, that's where you can really get an idea of what you're going to be required to do, and where you may be able to, in your own mind at least, achieve some efficiencies and some improvements, you know, to the federal program. And two of the or some of the areas that we're focused on right now with DNR assistance is looking at, can we get more flexibility in terms of wetlands mitigation? So in Alaska, where we have all these wetlands, if somebody disturbs a wetland, converts a wetland, that under the national rule, you have to replace it with other wetlands. And it's not just a one-for-one. You have to usually, you always have to do more wetland restoration than you lost. And so in a state that has so many wetlands, does that always make sense? Like if you're on the North Slope and you disturb 100 square feet of wetland, would it make more sense of trying to find somewhere else on the North Slope some more wetlands you can restore, or would it make more sense to deal with one of those legacy wells, for instance? You know, are there other environmental issues, water quality issues that in our minds may be have a higher priority? Other states, it makes, where they lost a lot of the wetlands, it makes perfect sense to me to make that the standing priority. But here we have a whole different situation. So that's one thing that we're looking at is that mitigation banking programs, in lieu of fee programs, because in Alaska we have so little wetlands to restore. What do you do if there's not a restoration project ready to go and you have to do mitigation? Well, can you bank some funds to do that? How is that managed? You know, how do you execute that? So these are the kind of practical things we're looking at to see if we can make a better workable program for Alaska. And so even if ultimately the recommendation or the legislator's decision is not to pursue this, hopefully we can work with the Corps at least to have a better program here. That's part of the objective. So those discussions are all taking place, and we're looking at a full report to the legislature in 2015. But that's the status.
You said there were two areas you're looking at. One was wetlands mitigation and flexibility. Was there a second one you identified that kind of missed?
What I mentioned was the mitigation banking and in lieu programs. Some of the other things that we're looking at, these are right now the EPA and the Corps collectively on a national level are looking at doing a rulemaking that would interpret the Waters of the United States language in the Clean Water Act. So we're looking closely at how that might affect what we get in terms of primacy. There's a number of different issues that we're working through with one of them, but I think those are the two big ones, is what we would get, Waters of the United States definition, how that might be impacted by a new rule, and then what flexibility we might get under the mitigation national rule and how that might change in Alaska if we had the program.
Good deal. Quick question. You got a question? No. My question is there any cost sharing? Is EPA or any federal agency helping to bear some of the financial costs of us doing that primacy study work?
Chairman Sadler, we applied for and we did get some grant money. I don't recall the amount right now. I don't know. Okay. There's nothing that comes with it, I can tell you that.
Okay, good deal. Questions for Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to remind myself, last year's legislation included the funding to do the entire review process, so there's not a request in this year for those staff, or is there?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, we got some PCNs and we got increments for them. And there was money there for DEC, and then a pass-through for DNR, not PCNs, but some money for law. Mm-hmm. And all that is being used for what was in the original appropriation. We didn't get the appropriation that would carry us all the way through to actually implementing it. You know, so, but you're right that this year we're not asking for any new funds. In fact, I think we're at a position right now for just taking us through fiscal year 14 and just using money that's available in 14. We probably are looking at, in the governor's budget, not using what was originally proposed for fiscal year 15 as part of the kind of the tightening and just going, but we're well set up with what we got right now for the next year or two. Mm-hmm.
And if you remind us again, this is designed to get us to the point where what's the decision to be made, and does the legislature make that decision, or is that DEC making an administrative decision as to whether we should proceed to apply for primacy or not?
Chairman Zather, what you're going to get is you'll get a preliminary report, then you'll get a final report with a recommendation. But the original legislation did contain an authorization. If the administration would go forward with doing an application, but you are the gatekeeper, as I mentioned last year in talking about the bill, is because there's no appropriation yet. And so we couldn't apply. I mean, we could apply, but it wouldn't go anywhere because you have to have the people hired before they'll consider your application. You have to have the program ready to go. Hmm. That's the way it was with NPDES too. So if we thought it was a good idea that to go forward, we would come back to the legislature, say, here's everything in our application, but we don't have the people yet. We need the appropriation. We need to go and hire the people. Then we can apply. Hmm. So we do have to come back to the legislature. You would have to appropriate the money before we could go forward.
Okay, good deal. Seaton?
Yep. Can you remind me how many employees we added for the other section, 402?
Section 402. The total number?
Yeah,
14.
14 and...
But that we had it's a little bit different. We had an existing program under 402. We were issuing state wastewater discharge permits under a separate state requirement, so we weren't starting as low down. We were already starting with a higher number than we would be with 404, so it's not exactly a good comparison.
So, Mr. Chairman, so what you're telling me is you probably need significantly more employees than 14 to add if we were going to do 404.
Representative, seeing through the chair, 402 and 404 would take a different number of people, and that's part of what we would assess as part of the what we're doing now, and we come back to you with that number. My guess is it would take fewer people for a 404 program than a 402, but I'll wait for the analysis.
Okay. Any questions? No? Okay.
Okay, so that's the 404 program, but that's just the status report.
Okay.
The other item that I wanted to give a quick status report on is on the cruise ship. We had legislation, HB 80, that made some changes in state law on it did two main things that I'll talk about here. One is there was an existing general permit the DEC had issued to cruise ships to allow them to discharge in state water. That general permit was due to expire before this last cruise season, and that was kind of what the exigency on getting a bill passed is because that permit was going to expire. And if we're going to issue a new permit, the problem was that the requirements they wouldn't be able to meet. That was the concern. And so one thing that happened is the legislature took that, looked at the expiration date on that permit that existed at the time, and they extended that to 2015. And then the other thing that happened that was a key piece of the legislation, it allowed DEC, it gave DEC the authority to allow cruise ships to apply for, in DEC, under its mixing zone regulations, to authorize mixing zones, assuming the application met our mixing zone requirements. And so we're in the process of developing a new general permit under the new authorizations that we got. It would be applying existing mixing zone just like we would apply mixing zone regulations or state water quality standards. Nothing's changed there. Just looking how we would apply those to cruise ships as we would apply it to a land-based facility or anybody else requesting a permit. So we're in the process of developing that draft general permit. It's largely done. It's in internal review within the department. We are looking at some of the details of the cruise ship industry, just the different ships that are coming up here that may be coming up in the next 5 years, what differences there might be over the next 5 years, and you know, just double-checking a lot of the permit and seeing if there's any reality checks that we need to do there. And then what we would be doing is we would be issuing that permit in draft for public review. So we'd go out for an extensive public review period and comment period, and we'd be taking the comments in on that, finalizing the permit, and issuing it. It may be issued for the 2014 season. We're getting kind of tight on that now. That's what my preference would be. But if it's not available for all of the 2014 season, then we still have the existing general permit that's in place through 2015.
Commissioner, could you just remind us, what are some of the conditions that have to be met in order to authorize a mixing zone, some of the protections? Because there was some concern about that in the public.
Yeah, there's a whole list. It's in our regulations. I remember there's like 17 different, if you added them up, different things that you have to meet. And they include things like no bioaccumulation, no lethality to passing fish, no loss of designated uses for the water body. I mean, the idea is that on a mixing zone is it's limited spatially where the discharge meets the receiving water to allow some mixing there to meet water quality standards. They have to meet it at the edge of that mixing zone. And a lot of the restrictions are is to require somebody to do the maximum they can do to treat or to limit their discharge, and then to limit the size of the mixing zone, the extent of it, to make it as small as practicable. And then also then to protect all the surrounding areas to make sure that there's no unintended consequences outside that limited area.
And not to put too fine a point in it, for the record, was there any degradation of water quality standards?
There wasn't any change in water quality standards. There was, you mean from the legislation? I mean, the reason I pause there is that the mixing zone requirements stayed the same. We just put cruise ships under the same requirements. I don't think of that as a water quality standard change, but I mean, that's all that happened, and the standards stayed the same. The requirements for a mixing zone stayed the same.
Thank you. Okay. You know, we had heard some discussion that there was, that technology could do great things. Has there been any review, any news of technological advantages or advances in the last year that would make a more stringent discharge standards possible?
Mr. Chairman, it's only been a year, so I think we haven't gone back and done a full-blown review, but we've done several different reviews, including, you might remember, there was the science advisory panel that met for a couple years leading up to the bill. And so, but the plan would be, just as we do on the oil and gas side, to periodically go back and look at best available technology and revisit that. But it's just been a year, so we haven't focused on that. As part of the permitting process itself, we sort of get into that because we have to look at the different ships, and we might see something on one ship, wondering why it's not on the next. I mean, it does naturally occur.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any questions on the discharging issues, Representative Parr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just noticed in the letter distributed from the director that there was some discussion about some summer meetings that took place to discuss the new general permit, and wonder if there was any feedback from the community or what the response was about the discussion about the mixing zones.
Yeah. If you'd like, Mr. Chair, I can invite our director up. She's the one that did those meetings, Michelle Hill.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm Michelle Hill, and I am the Director of the Division of Water for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Representative Tarr, through the chair, in general, the feedback was sometimes surprise. We just tried to demonstrate what was actually going on with the discharges. A lot of times what I would do, I traveled to Ketchikan, Sitka twice, and did several presentations in Juneau, so I would really try to tailor the talks to what was going on in those different communities on those days, just giving them an idea of what the discharges were and what the discharge characteristics were. And the response was typically quite positive, that the impacts from these discharges really were not as extreme as some people had thought.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Director. The question is, Representative Seaton.
Since we have water quality up here, I have a question on, it's a little bit off the main topic that we've been talking about, but right now DEC is requiring the mariculture farmers, the shellfish farmers in Ketchmack Bay, to sample water not at their sites but at 9 points around Ketchmack Bay. They have to sample all of these sites. You know, they're running in a skiff or something, trying to go to 9 places all around the bay, and they have to send those all in within 12 hours. And I'm trying to figure out how we are putting on an industry the sampling of water in an entire bay that are not at their farm sites, and whether this is just regulatorily imposed or whether this is something that, I mean, I don't know where it came from that individuals are responsible for sampling an entire water body for DEC baseline data.
Reverend Seaton, through the chair, that would be a different program. That would be food Safety and Sanitation and Environmental Health Department that oversee food safety associated with the mariculture program. And I have to get back to you with the full answer on that as to the purpose of that sampling, but it's probably unique to that particular harvest area. And I could guess at the issues, but I'd rather have them give you a full answer.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But it'd be a food safety requirement. That's what it would be stemming from.
Okay. Good deal.
Thanks.
Can I share with us all, please? The interest is high in one corner. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a quick follow-up to that other question. I was trying to remember to get the details right, because I think when we worked on the DEC budget in relation, you know, the discussion about the discharges, there was some intent language about making that that information available to the public. So it sounds like then you were able to do that through the presentations. And I guess that's what I was trying to get an update on that, and if that has been made available in a different way. Because I think it was supposed to be, Representative Seaton was on the budget subcommittee, that individuals could see on a map where the cruise ship was, you know, sort of the route, like you're tracking an airplane, kind of that same idea. And had all of those kind of changes been implemented, and is that how you presented the information so the public knows how to find that?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, unfortunately it was not quite that comprehensive. And yes, we have responded to that intent language, and really what we're doing is we're responding on an ongoing basis. As we get more information, we put more information on the web. We're mm-hmm. certainly not at the point right now where we can, you know, show the track of the cruise ships and what is being discharged at any location. We have actually put a web page up on our cruise ship website with some information on mixing zones. And so there is some information available, and as we get more, we'll get more out there.
Thank you.
Okay. See, no other questions? Any wrap-up, Commissioner?
That's everything I had for today, and certainly we'll follow up on all these good questions. I appreciate everybody's interest and a lot of good questions today. Thank you.
Thank you. And do you make it the information available to either Trevor Fulton or Linda Hay? We can distribute it to all our members, and if we need to, we'll get back with the other follow-up questions. With nothing else to come before the committee, we will adjourn. After break, we will look forward to meeting with the Department of Natural Resources on Friday, and at 2:30, we'll adjourn. Thank you very much.